Iran says it has received the first data from remote sensing Hayam satellite hours after it was launched into space aboard a Russian Soyuz rocket. China issues yet another warning to the U.S. over Taiwan, saying it will fight back every provocation by Washington that undermines its sovereignty. Pentagon confirms for the first time that it is supplying Ukraine with anti-radar missiles to use against Russia in the war.
Well, welcome to the studios from the capital, Tehran. This is Mews. Thanks for joining us.
The Iranian Ministry of Information and Communications says it has received the first data from the Hayam satellite hours after it was launched into space from a base in Kazakhstan. The ministry says the data was received at the Iranian Space Agency's Mahdash base. Hayam aboard a Russian Soyuz rocket was blasted off from Baikonur Cosmodrome Tuesday. The remote sensing satellite can sense space images with a resolution accuracy of 1 meter. President Ebrahim Raisi has hailed the successful launch of the satellite, calling it a moment of pride. Raisi says Iran will benefit from more advances in the aerospace field, which will be helpful for various areas like the environment, as well as in monitoring the country's borders. Meanwhile, the head of the Iranian Space Agency has dismissed as childish claims by Washington that the satellite is for spying purposes. Following the launch, the U.S. expressed anger at Iran's partnership with Russia and leveled an accusation that the satellite is aimed at spying. A Palestinian man has died of wounds that he sustained during Israel's strikes on the besieged Gaza Strip during the weekend. The man was critically injured after Israeli missiles hit a residential neighborhood in the city of Beit Hanun. His death brings to 47 the number of Gazans killed during the three-day Israeli assault on the besieged territory. 4 women and 16 children are among the dead, while some 360 were wounded. In response to Israeli attacks, the Islamic Jihad resistance movement fired hundreds of rockets at Israeli cities, including Tel Aviv, Sderot, and Ashkelon. And Egypt broke a truce and did the latest bout of Israeli strikes on Gaza. 4 Palestinians have been killed in the occupied West Bank. Israeli military killed 3 Palestinians, including a fighter and a member of the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade, Ibrahim al-Nabulsi, in Nablus. A 4th Palestinian was killed during a protest in Al-Khalil.
Israeli forces have assassinated Ibrahim al-Nabulsi, a resistance fighter and commander of the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade in the occupied West Bank city of Nablus. Israeli troops raided Nablus early Tuesday and surrounded a building in the old city where al-Nabulsi had barricaded himself in. A gunfight lasted for several hours with Israeli forces even firing anti-tank missiles at the building. 32-year-old Islam Sabouh and 16-year-old teen Hussein Jamal Taha were also killed in the raid. At least 60 Palestinians were wounded, according to the Palestinian Health Ministry.
We have not witnessed such an aggressive raid to Nablus in years. The aim was to assassinate al-Nablusi and any other Palestinian who was assisting him. He refused to surrender and clashed with the soldiers for hours and was finally martyred.
As the raid started, we rushed to the old town, but the soldiers had blocked the neighborhood. They opened fire at us. We tried to evacuate the wounded, including a woman, but they continued shooting at us. Dozens were wounded as a result.
Israeli Prime Minister Yair Lapid has reacted to Nablus operation, saying that the killing of whom he described as terrorist Ibrahim Nabulsi was another step in Israel's uncompromising fight against terrorism.
This cell has been worrying Israeli military. They carried out a number of shooting against Israeli soldiers and settlers. That is why the Israeli military wanted to strike them and kill one of its leaders.
A number of West Bank cities, including Ramallah and Al-Khalil, observed commercial strikes as part of a period of mourning and in protest at the killings in Nablus. The regime forces clashed with the protesters in Al-Khalil and shot dead at least one Palestinian.
It has become clear that Israel is targeting any Palestinian who is honored as a real fighter. The regime might succeed in assassinating those fighters like Ibrahim al-Nabulsi, but they would even be remembered as heroes and icons who devoted their lives to fighting Israeli soldiers. Mona Kandil, Occupy Ramallah.
Up next is a new episode of Hashtag Trending. Let's see how social media reacts to the new Israel bloodshed in the besieged Gaza Strip and the occupied West Bank.
Hey everyone, Ali Reza here. Thanks for tuning in to another Hashtag Trending. Palestinians have mourned the death of Ibrahim al-Nabulsi, an Islamic Jihad fighter who was killed during an Israeli raid in the occupied West Bank city of Nablus. The Israeli military has been conducting deadly raids almost on a daily basis in the occupied territories. Nabulsi was martyred after Israeli soldiers raided a house in Nablus, destroying the structure using shoulder-fired missiles. The raid also triggered an exchange of fire between Israeli soldiers and the Palestinians. Now, social media users have reacted to the fresh outbreak of violence in the West Bank. They have called for urgent action to stop Israel's crimes against the Palestinians. Let's have a look at our first batch of tweets. The first one comes from Malaka. She said, "Israel is done with Gaza for now. It's turned to Nablus and killed three Palestinians just like this. And the news will not even make it to international media. Pure desensitization to Palestinian suffering." Here's our next tweet by Tara. She wrote, "Zionist violence never stops, regardless of a ceasefire. Three young men were just killed by the IOF, Israeli occupation forces, in Nablus. IOF is still raiding homes in the occupied West Bank and Jerusalem al-Quds. There are 4,650 political prisoners, including 180 children. Gaza is still under a land, air, and sea blockade." The raid in the West Bank came just hours after a ceasefire was announced in the Gaza Strip. Israel attacked Gaza last week and killed dozens of Palestinians, including two senior Islamic Jihad commanders. Now, social media users have criticized the international silence over Israel's crimes, like this tweet by Samardi Jarrah, which is rather passive-aggressive and, I would say, directed at the international community and not necessarily just the organizations. Here's what she said. "Go back to sleep. This is Gaza, not Ukraine." Over here, Khaled Beydoun has a tweet in a similar vein, just a little bit more direct. He said, "16 children have died in Gaza in 72 hours. Where's the global outrage and humanitarianism?" Now here's a video posted by Mohammad Samiri. He said, "Rahaf Soleiman lost her legs and right arm during the Israeli aggression on Gaza." The Gaza Strip has been under an Israeli blockade since 2007. That is 15 years, and the Palestinians living there have been living under immense pressure as a result of the constant Israeli aggression against them. Our first tweet of our final batch of comments comes from Laith Hanbali. "Just like after every assault, dozens of Gaza's youth take to the streets as soon as the truce kicks in to clean up the devastation inflicted by the colonizers." Over here, another tweet by Nadir Baluch. "The Zionist state won't allow electricity to go into Gaza. There's a severe medical and electrical supply there." I assume he meant several medical and electrical supply shortage there. "Remember, Gaza is an open-air prison. Please always keep Palestine in your prayers. May Allah grant them victory soon." And our final comment comes from David Shoebridge. "Endless war, endless occupation. More and more children are killed. When will the world demand an end to Israel's open-ended violence against Gaza and the Palestinian people?" Well, that's a wrap for another Hashtag Trending. Take care and bye-bye.
China vows it will fight back every U.S. provocation that undermines its sovereignty.
"Every time the U.S. side makes a serious provocative act of infringing on China's sovereignty and interfering in China's internal affairs, the Chinese side will resolutely fight back. China will never allow its sovereignty and territorial integrity to be wantonly trampled on and sabotaged."
The Foreign Ministry's spokesman issued the warning amid rising tensions over a recent controversial visit by the U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi to Taiwan. After her trip, Pelosi said Washington would not allow China to isolate the self-ruled island. Wang described the trip as a major political provocation aimed at upgrading U.S.-Taiwan exchanges. He noted that Beijing had warned the U.S. that the visit would harm bilateral ties. He once again urged Washington to uphold the One China principle and to avoid using Taiwan to contain the country. China claims Taiwan as its own territory and has repeatedly warned against the island's growing nexus with the U.S. Earlier today, Beijing also vowed zero tolerance for separatist activities on the island as both sides engage in separate military drills in a show of strength. The U.S. says it has sent anti-radar missiles to Ukraine to help it target Russia's radar systems in the ongoing war between the two neighbors. The Pentagon says the missiles are the high-speed anti-radiation missile, or HARM, and were included in the $1 billion in additional military aid package for Kiev. There's no mention of the exact number, but it is the first time the Defense Department has revealed sending the previously undisclosed missiles to Ukraine. The Ukrainian authorities have not publicly acknowledged receiving or using HARMs, but in recent days, some reports have shown the remains of what appear to be the fin of a HARM missile that targeted a Russian position in Ukraine. The U.S. has sent $9.8 billion in military aid to Kiev since the launch of Russia's military offensive there in February. The veteran Syrian politician has blasted the U.S. for stealing the country's natural resources.
The United States is currently occupying Syrian territories and plundering Syria's grain and oil resources. These actions of the United States are very shameful. Hence, we never trust anything the United States says, because what they say is seriously contrary to what they do.
Shaban also condemned Washington's illegal military presence in Syria. She made the remarks as the latest data released by the Syrian Ministry of Oil and Mineral Resources show the U.S. has been plundering most of oil produced in the country. The ministry says the U.S. and militant groups it supports pillaged over 80% of daily oil production in the first half of 2022. Damascus considers the U.S. presence as an outright violation of its sovereignty. It has repeatedly deplored Washington for supporting armed groups and for stealing natural resources. The U.S. federal court has found a former Twitter manager guilty of spying for Saudi Arabia's royal family. Ahmed Abu Amon was convicted on 6 criminal charges, including fraud, money laundering, and conspiracy. He was hired by a close advisor to Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman for gaining access to personal information of Saudi dissidents. Prosecutors said that Abu Amon, dual U.S.-Lebanese citizen, received at least $300,000 for sharing private information of Twitter users. Also, Ali Al-Zabara, colleague of Abu Amon, was accused of accessing Twitter accounts on behalf of Saudi Arabia. He left the U.S. before being charged. Riyadh was accused of spying on the U.S. for the first time with the arrest and the indictment of Abu Amon in late 2019. Yemen's Ministry of Human Rights has held a press conference in the capital Sana'a on the allegations and fallacies of the Secretary General of the United Nations, Antonio Guterres, regarding the situation of Yemeni children throughout the years of Saudi Arabia's war on Yemen. Abdul Latif al-Washali has more.
Yemen's Ministry of Human Rights has held a press conference on the dire situation of Yemeni children amid the years-long Saudi war on the country. The ministry has criticized the United Nations for its inaction on Saudi atrocities.
When the United Nations removed Saudi Arabia from the list of violators of children's rights, it encouraged the kingdom to continue killing Yemeni children and targeting service facilities for children such as schools, hospitals and health centers. It also prevented the entry of humanitarian and medical aid for children. We know that there are UN reports that talk about the spread of malnutrition amongst children, along with many chronic diseases that need care. But unfortunately, there is no real action to save the children of Yemen.
Officials say the UN has collaborated with the Saudi-led coalition in killing Yemeni children by providing political cover-up for Riyadh's violations. Moreover, the world body removed the kingdom from the list of groups accused of violating children's rights.
The United Nations is a clear and prominent partner in the aggressive war on Yemen, and we have in the 8 years of war clear evidence that the United Nations participated in all the crimes committed against the Yemenis and did not condemn Saudi Arabia for its crimes, but rather the victims hear everything the executioner does. The United Nations has contributed to the killing of Yemeni children through its silence and coverage of Saudi crimes. It has also removed Saudi Arabia 5 times from the list of violators of children's rights.
According to human rights groups, more than 9,000 children have been killed or maimed by Saudi airstrikes since the beginning of the war in 2015. Health officials say more than 1 million children are suffering from malnutrition, one of the highest numbers in the world.
Human rights activists say the United Nations is hostage to Saudi Arabia's funding for its programs. They say the world body has contributed to the killing of Yemeni children because of its silence on Saudi crimes. Abdul Latif al-Washali, Sana'a.
Tens of thousands of Shia Muslims took to the streets in Indian-administered Kashmir to mark the martyrdom anniversary of the Prophet Muhammad's grandson, Imam Hussein. Our correspondent has more.
Streets in parts of Muslim-majority Kashmir flooded with mourners clad in black, waving flags and banners with messages from the battlefield of Karbala written over them. Young and old, men and women participated in the mourning ceremonies on the day of Ashura. Ashura marks the day when Imam Hussein and his companions were martyred by forces of tyrant Yazid in Karbala. To carry forward Imam Hussein's legacy, centuries after the Battle of Karbala, Imam Hussein's martyrdom is commemorated across the globe.
These processions during the month of Muharram have a message. First, to keep the younger generations posted, and second, to not let the world forget how good won over the evil.
Reciting elegies, chanting pro-Islamic slogans, and the resonating sound of chest beating, every eye is moist in memory of the battle for humanity.
We have been entrusted with a mission, and it becomes our responsibility to carry the lessons and teachings forward so that our upcoming generations know their legacy well.
Each year during the holy month of Muharram, religious organizations and groups organize seminars, processions and lectures. Here in Kashmir, authorities have demarcated the routes for Muharram processions, mostly in Shia-dominated areas. Following a three-decade-old ban imposed on Muharram processions through traditional routes, authorities in sensitive Kashmir believe these emotional mourning processions may turn into a law and order problem, thus arrangements are made in confined areas.
For Muslims, the event of Karbala marks a new beginning of resilience. The processions held year after year reinforce integrity towards the mission of truth, justice and peace initiated by Imam Hussein some 1400 years ago on the battlefield of Karbala. Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The extradition, trial, and conviction of Julian Assange would have frightening ramifications for investigative journalism, says Marjorie Kahn, journalist, in an article published under the heading "Julian Assange is enduring unbearable persecution for exposing U.S. war crimes." Stay tuned for more. Ever since UK Home Secretary Priti Patel formally ordered the extradition of WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange to the US last week, press freedom advocates around the world have been mobilizing. Assange Defense is organizing a national and international campaign to pressure U.S. Attorney General Merrick Garland and Joe Biden to drop the extradition request and dismiss the charges against Assange. The stakes could not be higher. The charges against Assange, including 17 under the infamous Espionage Act, could result in 175 years in prison for the journalist who exposed U.S. war crimes. Last week, Assange's brother, filmmaker Gabriel Shipton, wrote in an email to Truthout, UK Home Secretary has decided today that any publisher who exposes national security information of an allied country may face extradition to 2 lifetimes in prison. Julian will appeal this decision and this once-in-a-lifetime fight for freedom of the press continues. Assange indictment is based on WikiLeaks' 2010 to 2011 disclosures of U.S. war crimes in Iraq, Afghanistan, and the military prison at Guantanamo. Those revelations included 400,000 field reports about the Iraq war, 15,000 unreported deaths of Iraqi civilians, and systematic rape, torture, and murder committed by U.S. forces, handed over detainees to a notorious Iraqi torture squad. WikiLeaks also disclosed the war logs, which are 90,000 reports or more civilian casualties by coalition forces than the U.S. military had admitted to in Afghanistan. And its revelations additionally included the Guantanamo files, 779 secret reports showing that 150 innocent people had been held there for years, and documenting the torture and abuse of 800 men and boys in violation of the Geneva Conventions and the Convention Against Torture and Other Cruel, Inhuman, and Degrading Treatment or Punishment. WikiLeaks also published the notorious collateral murder video, which documented how in 2007, a U.S. Army Apache helicopter gunship targeted and fired on unarmed civilians in Baghdad. At least 18 civilians were killed. They included 2 Reuters reporters and a man who came to rescue the wounded. 2 children were injured. Then a U.S. Army tank drove over one of the bodies, severing it in half. That video contains evidence of 3 separate war crimes that are prohibited by the Geneva Conventions and the U.S. Army Field Manual. As several civil liberties and human rights organizations declared in October 2021, when they asked Garland to dismiss the case against Assange, his prosecution poses a significant threat to First Amendment freedom of the press. The UK's decision to extradite Julian Assange to the nation that plotted to assassinate him, the nation that wants to imprison him for 175 years for publishing truthful information in the public interest, is an abomination, wrote Noam Chomsky, Daniel Ellsberg, and Alice Walker, co-chairs of Assange Defense, in reaction to Patel's extradition order. The U.S. government argues that its venerated constitution does not protect journalism the government dislikes and that publishing truthful information in the public interest is a subversive criminal act. This argument is a threat not only to journalism but to democracy itself. Trevor Tim, Executive Director of Freedom of the Press Foundation, warned that if Assange is extradited to the United States and convicted of the charges against him, it would potentially make receiving classified information, asking for sources for more information, and publishing certain types of classified information a crime. Tim noted, journalists, of course, engage in all these activities regularly. Moreover, Assange has suffered psychological torture while confined in the UK for more than a decade, according to Nils Meltzer, United Nations Special Rapporteur on Torture. In December 2021, Meltzer tweeted that the UK is literally torturing him to death. On June 10th, more than 300 doctors, psychiatrists and psychologists calling themselves Doctors for Assange wrote to Petal that Assange's deteriorating health made it medically and ethically unacceptable to extradite him. Julian's 13-year persecution culminates in a decision of ostentatious, callous indifference, John Shipton, Assange's father, told Truthout, adding, "Who amongst us would not burn with indignation and loathing?" Stella Assange, who recently married Julian in prison, called Petal's decision a dark day for press freedom and for British democracy. She told the Associated Press, "Julian did nothing wrong. He has committed no crime and is not a criminal. He is a journalist and a publisher, and he is being punished for doing his job." Yet UK officials disregarded Assange's health and the injustice of his prosecution, insisting that the US would treat him appropriately. In its June 17th statement ordering Assange's extradition, the UK Home Office wrote, "In this case, the UK courts have not found that it would be oppressive, unjust, or an abuse of process to extradite Mr. Assange, nor have they found that extradition would be incompatible with his human rights, including his right to a fair trial and to the freedom of expression, and that whilst in the US, he will be treated appropriately, including in relation to his health." But after a three-week evidentiary hearing, UK District Judge Vanessa Baritzer ruled in January 2021 that if Assange were extradited to the United States, he would likely attempt suicide because of his mental state and the onerous conditions of confinement in US prisons. The United States later came forward with qualified assurances that Assange wouldn't be kept in solitary confinement, and the UK High Court reversed Baritzer's decision in January 2022. The UK Supreme Court affirmed the High Court's dismissal of Assange's appeal in March, paving the way for Petal's decision ordering extradition. Amnesty International Agnes Callamard, former UN Special Rapporteur on Extrajudicial Summary or Arbitrary Execution, was skeptical of the so-called assurances that Assange would be treated humanely in US custody. "Diplomatic assurances provided by the US that Assange will not be kept in solitary confinement cannot be taken on face value given previous history," Callamard said, referring to the US reneging on past extradition assurances. Assange now has until July 1st to appeal Petal's decision and apply to the High Court to reverse Baritzer's ruling on the other issues Assange raised on the extradition hearing. Assange will also raise on appeal the CIA's plot to kidnap and assassinate him while he was in the Ecuadorian embassy under a grant of asylum. If Assange loses his appeals to the UK High Court and Supreme Court, he could appeal to the European Court of Human Rights. The appeals could take several months or even years. The indictment against Assange has been assigned to U.S. District Judge Claude M. Hilton, who jailed former U.S. Army intelligence analyst Chelsea Manning in 2019 for refusing to appear before a federal grand jury investigating Assange. The indictment charges that Assange conspired with Manning to gain access to a government computer. This is the first time the United States has prosecuted a journalist or media outlet for publishing classified information. The extradition, trial, and conviction of Julian Assange would have frightening ramifications for investigative journalism. On June 17th, the editorial board of The Guardian wrote, "This action potentially opens the door for journalists anywhere in the world to be extradited to the U.S. for exposing information deemed classified by Washington."
علي حبه جنة وسيم النار والجنة وسي المصطفى حقا إمام الناس والجنة.
The Gate of Knowledge. Exegesis and interpretations of the supremely eloquent sermons, letters, and sayings of the Commander of the Faithful, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him.
You're listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وعلى أهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين. Dear listeners to IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. I welcome you all to this episode of The Gate of Knowledge, where we are discussing about the topic of the Charter of Islamic Governance based on the teachings of Imam Ali alayhi salam in Nahjul Balagha. Once again, we are focusing on the 16th sermon of Nahjul Balagha, whereby Imam Ali alayhi salam, after mentioning his strategy, talks about a very important issue, and that is the issue of truth and falsehood, because it is very important for human beings to be able to have that capacity to recognize the truth and the falsehood so that they can follow the truth and stay away from what is wrong and what is false. And this is obvious, basically. But one of the things that really helps a human being in this direction is to be aware of of the sunnah of Allah, of those general repetitive principles, those that repeat in the history. As you know, history is like a repeating clip. You know how some clips, video clips or audio clips, they repeat. You click the repeat button and it keeps on repeating. History is like that. It repeats itself. Why does it repeat itself? It's because there are principles that govern it. And when those issues occur that would lead to a certain event to happen, again, that event repeats itself.
You're listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio, a program that presents a detailed commentary of Peak of Eloquence from the Master of the Faithful, Imam Ali, peace be upon him.
Welcome back, dear listeners, to IRIB English Radio. We are discussing about the topic of truth and falsehood and the importance of recognizing the truth and falsehood. And one of the things that will really help us is to analyze history properly and to see how it can help us in understanding the world of today and the challenges that we are facing. And Imam Ali alayhi salam is stressing in this sermon about the reality, about the truth. Now, as you know that after Uthman was killed by some people, the Ummah chose Imam Ali alayhi salam as the caliph. Of course, he deserved the caliphate without even people choosing him. And he deserved the very first caliphate. He was the one who was given that special position by Imam Ali alayhi, by the Holy Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam. But of course, you know what happens in history, and therefore that we leave it to another discussion. But when Imam Ali alayhi salam comes to power, there are different, you know, historians who have different opinions, and they say that the reason why the people chose Imam Ali alayhi salam is that they were tired of the obstruction and the, you can say, and the constriction that they were facing at the time of Uthman. And because there was some level of this mismanagement and lack of control and you can say favorism and a lot of constriction in that time, people were forced to take the direction, or rather they decided to take the direction of choosing Imam Ali alayhi salam, of justice, of having a good leader like Imam Ali alayhi salam. But is this the only factor that led the people to take this path of choosing Imam Ali alayhi salam? Is it just because they felt the pain that they decided to take the path of truth? Isn't it the fact that in different parts of the world, people suffer pain, people suffer oppression, people suffer from difficulties? But do they always, because of that, choose the right direction? Or is there something more important in choosing the right path after recognizing the pain that a person is facing? Inshallah, we'll discuss about this in the coming segment.
Stay tuned to the IRIB English Radio.
Welcome back, dear listeners, to IRIB English Radio. Some of the historians are of this opinion that because people were under pressure at the time of Uthman, they decided to follow and take and accept Imam Ali alayhi salam as their leader after him. But we say that just feeling a certain difficulty or a certain constriction or pain is not enough for you to take the right direction. Sometimes people feel the pain, but they are not able to choose the right path after that. You can see so many examples in history. People were under pressure, under oppression, and they suffered, and they felt the suffering. But as a result of that suffering, they did not choose the right path. They might have made a revolution, but they ended up following the wrong path, a path of falsehood. For example, communism, socialism, and all of these different isms that exist in the world were actually the results of a certain pressure that a community faced. The working class were tired, let's say, of a certain way of ruling, and therefore they decided to uprise. But which path did they take after that? Was it the path of truth? Was that the path that was really something that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala wanted? We see many, many times these revolutions, these changes in the society were not in the right direction. So the problem is that the pain, first of all, is not recognized properly. The second thing is, even if the pain is recognized properly, there should be another factor that makes you take the path of truth. And that is the important determining issue. Recognizing the pain, the actual problem, and number two, to find the right solution, the right direction. So apart from that feeling of pressure, difficulty, constriction, there has to be an awareness of what is the right thing, the truth, and the right direction. And that is when a society will be able to come out of the clutches of difficulties that they are facing. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome. on the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio.
قال النبي محمد من كنت مولاه هذا علي سيد فاز من ولاه هو بالكتاب مسدد والنور معنا باب العلوم ومرشد هو آيات الله من ناداه أو لبه حين دعاه نال مناه هو في الشدائد منجد والفضل يمنى هو في المحاسن أحمد والوحي ربا.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight. Recently, Labour's Shadow Chancellor Rachel Reeves was at pains to explain that the British government has lost control of the economy, adding that as families and pensioners worry about how they're going to pay their bills, the Tory leadership candidates are touring the country announcing unworkable policies that will do nothing to help people get through this crisis. We now present you an article written by Reza Javadi, a PhD student in British Studies at the University of Tehran. The piece is titled, Truss vs. Sunak, Race for UK Leadership Heats Up Amid Looming Recession. Cutthroat race to number 10 Downing Street is in full swing, with two formidable figures and seasoned campaigners fighting it out for the coveted chair to replace Boris Johnson, who faced an unceremonious exit recently after a string of scandals rocked his government. Former British Chancellor of the Exchequer Rishi Sunak and Foreign Secretary Liz Truss are the remaining two candidates in the fray, among 11 Conservative MPs who submitted their bids for the British Premiership. Rishi Sunak, a 42-year-old, spearheaded the rebellion against Boris Johnson when he announced his resignation as Chancellor of the Exchequer in early July, saying the public expects the government to be conducted properly, competently and seriously. Born in southeast of England to Indian origin parents, Rishi Sunak, in his leadership campaign, has primarily focused on his family's immigrant roots in order to win the favour of his party and people. He has also pledged to implement the controversial Rwanda policy, which is an attempt by the British government to repatriate asylum seekers in the country to Rwanda, 4,000 miles away. The underdog in the race is opposed to cutting taxes and has said that he would wait for the inflation to subside before going on a tax-cutting spree. Interestingly, it was revealed earlier this year that his billionaire heiress wife had avoided millions of pounds in taxes, which prompted many to seek his resignation. Rishi Sunak, who was involved in the infamous Partygate scandal and fined by police for breaching the government's own COVID-19 protocol, has the shadow of many scandals that brought down Boris Johnson hovering over him. Thus, his popularity in the Conservative Party is profoundly influenced by his records in the cabinet. Liz Truss, a 46-year-old whose dogmatism may not help her in navigating the challenges of being at the helm, has pledged to slash $36 billion in taxes to be paid for through borrowing. According to a YouGov opinion poll for the Times newspaper carried out from 29th of July to 2nd of August, Liz Truss had the support of 60% of Conservative members versus 26% for Rishi Sunak. While the remainder of the nearly 1,000 members polled either were undecided or not planning to vote. Considering all of the existing factors, Liz Truss appears to have a slight edge over Rishi Sunak. Liz Truss, who was chosen by Boris Johnson first as the Trade Minister and then as Foreign Secretary, returned the favour by supporting Johnson when he was caught in the web of scandals and stood by him until his final weeks in office. Now she is gearing up to take his place at number 10 Downing Street. Among her much-publicised plans to fix the country's economy is cutting taxes and decreasing the burden on Britons, which has been widely welcomed by members of the Conservative Party. Tim Bale, a professor of politics at Queen Mary, University of London, is a close observer of the Conservative Party. He told CNN, "The average age of a party member is the late 50s. Just under half are of pensionable age, and they are predominantly white." Tim Bale added, "They mostly live in southern England and are financially comfortable. They support a strong line of law and order. They approve of low taxes." Given the cost of living crisis, the main challenge for people has been increasing taxes and sharp hikes in prices, which Liz Truss has promised to take up as the first priority of her premiership. While she believes that cutting taxes would give a flip to the economy, Rishi Sunak calls it fantasy economics by Truss, given the UK is still recovering from the economic shock of the COVID-19 pandemic. Both candidates are trying to appeal to the Conservative Party base at a time when the British economy is stagnant and has caused Britons to struggle with skyrocketing inflation and a cost-of-living crisis. Recently, Labour's Shadow Chancellor Rachel Reeves was at pains to explain that the British government has lost control of the economy, adding that as families and pensioners worry about how they're going to pay their bills, the Tory leadership candidates are touring the country announcing unworkable policies that will do nothing to help people get through this crisis. The eventual winner will face the challenge of reviving Britain's economy. Weaker trade after Brexit, coronavirus pandemic, high energy prices following Russia's special operation in Ukraine, and a series of scandals under Boris Johnson's watch have all damaged the Conservative Party. The fears among leading Conservative members are growing over the fact that regardless of which candidate wins, the Conservative Party will end up being the main loser, given all the accusations that are being exchanged between the rivals to destroy one another. The last two candidates in the race will be trying to convince party members to back them at hustings events around the country until 31st of August. The party members, whose number reaches about 200,000, will give a postal vote then. The ballot will close on 2nd of September, with the winner due to be announced on 5th of September. While on the domestic front, the two Prime Minister hopefuls have contrasting stances, they appear to be on the same page on the country's foreign policy, especially the policy towards West Asia. According to parliamentary voting data, their views on issues affecting the region appear largely similar. following Boris Johnson's deep footprint on most of the foreign policy matters, a Sunak government would mean a continuation of the same policy, supporting Western intervention in Syria and Iraq, continuing arms exports to Saudi Arabia, opposing Iran's peaceful nuclear program, supporting the Israeli regime's clandestine nuclear activities and destabilization plots in the region. Rishi Sunak's priorities are likely to be heavily domestic and suggest the continuation of the status quo. Liz Truss's prospective administration seems to have a clearer foreign policy approach in contrast to Rishi Sunak's, in line with their record in the cabinet. It will be interesting to see her stance on the restoration of the 2015 nuclear deal. As a top diplomat, she spoke of getting Iran back to the negotiating table, even though Iran never left the table in the first place. Britain's role in the Vienna talks as a member of the European Troika has been duplicitous. She is also expected to aggressively take up the cases of British nationals jailed in Iran for espionage. Regarding her policy towards the Arabian periphery states of the Persian Gulf, she is likely to strengthen ties with Arab states and promote her notion of a liberty network of the countries in the Persian Gulf Cooperation Council, the PGCC. Regardless of who takes the pole position, the next Prime Minister of Britain would have to focus more on domestic crises rather than poking their nose into other countries.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
And every night and every day, never forget to say, La ilaha illallah. Never forget to say, La ilaha illallah.
IRIB English Radio, a heralder of unity and solidarity amongst Islamic denominations.
Oh Lord, here I am, pleading at your door. Send me your mercy, send me your peace, or I am lost for sure.
Hadith of the day.
Here I am, yearning for your cure. This humble servant will be diverted from you no more, no more, no more.
You're listening to the program Hadith of the Day with Dr. Shiraz Hossein Agha on IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program Hadith of the Day here at IRIB English Radio. Today on Hadith of the Day, we would like to offer our condolences to our esteemed listeners and audience on the martyrdom of Imam Zainul Abidin, Imam Sajjad alayhi salam, the fourth Imam of the family of the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa sallam. Today on Hadith of the Day, we would like to recite for you a beautiful hadith narrated from Imam Baqir alayhi salam, the son of Imam Sajjad, regarding his father. This indicates the status of Imam Zainul Abidin, his virtues, as his nobility, and as well as his social services that he conducted with the people of his time and his era. Imam Baqir alayhi salam said, "Verily he," meaning Imam Sajjad alayhi salam, "used to provide for 100 households from among the poor of Medina. He liked for the orphans, the needy, the disabled, the poor, and the destitute to be present at his food spread, at his tablecloth." He liked this, he enjoyed this, he invited these groups of the needy to come and eat with him. Not only did he invite them to come eat with him, rather, he also personally and individually served them the food. And this is why, in continuation, Imam Baqir says, he served them with his own hands. وَكَانَ يُنَاوِلُهُمْ بِيَدِهِ Then the Imam says, if anyone among them had a family, he used to take the food to their household. And he wouldn't even, give them some food and say, "Hey, take this for your family, you know, at home, they might enjoy it." No, he would actually personally, take the food packet and, come with that person and give that food to that needy person's family. You know, if somebody comes to our house, a needy person or something, and to come eat with us, sometimes we give the person the food and say, "Hey, you can also give this to somebody, part of your family members or whatever." But who is like Imam Sajjad, who would actually go with the person to his house and take the food to his house? This is a very virtuous and noble quality that we, that is deserving to be adopted by us. In the end of this hadith, Imam Baqir alayhi salam says, he never ate any food, but that he first gave charity from it. Right. So not only did he invite these poor people to his house, not only did he serve them with his own hands, not only did he take the food for their family, but he never even began and ate the food before them. Rather, he would make sure that they would be the first ones to eat from it, and then would he begin eating himself. What a good model and a good example Imam Sajjad alayhi salam was for us. Thank you for joining us here on Hadith of the Day. Once again, we would like to offer our condolences on the martyrdom of Imam Sajjad. Until next time, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Dr. Shiraz Hossein Agha for the program Hadith of the Day on RIB English Radio.
اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد
Lebanon's Hezbollah chief has stressed that resistance is the only option for Palestinian people in their present circumstances. He reminded the fact that Hezbollah stands at the forefront of the battle against the Quds occupied regime. On the home front, the Hezbollah chief has stressed the resistance movement will not allow Israel to even imagine plundering the Lebanese natural resources. Now, the warning is made amid a maritime dispute over the Karish gas field in the Mediterranean.